Hello and welcome to the podcast of Manchester School of Theology. On February the 10th, 2024, we had a session where we looked at the topic of race and the story of God with Owen Hilton. And this is the first part of that session when Owen was talking about reconciliation as the way to unity. We hope you enjoy this content, and you can find more from us on our website at schooloftheology.co.uk.
The way we're going to do it is I'm going to talk for a bit, and then I will get you just to like break into groups. And I haven't set you questions. It's more like reflect on what I've been saying, think about some stuff, and then we'll come back for a question and response time. And I say that because I deliberately call it question and response, because I might not be able to answer all of your questions. Although in truth, I may have heard a lot of them because I've done this in quite a few different places around the country. So we'll do that. So there'll be an opportunity for some back and forth. If you do have questions, I'll try and answer them. The other thing it's probably worth me saying is I'm not trying to offend you. Yeah, that's my aim here isn't to like, okay, I've got an opportunity, let me really. I'm not trying to offend you, but some of what I say you might find challenging. Yeah, so I just need to be upfront with that. It's not my heart to offend, but it is definitely my heart to help us grow in our understanding of this issue as churches. And that has always been my kind of intention with it. What I would say is, obviously, 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, you probably didn't have a session on race and reconciliation and the church and all of those things. I don't think that's because, oh, yeah, it's become a thing. You know, off the back of George Floyd or whatever, this has become a thing. I would say that race reconciliation has been a neglected theology in the church. It's not like a new one. You know, the church might have to grapple, how do we deal with AI? That's not this. This is something, as Tom said, when you look at it, the New Testament church were grappling with it for a long time. And even God makes reference to it in the Old Testament. The way we're going to do the two sessions, again, because it's not a standard thing that we're talking about, the first session we're going to do, we'll look a little bit at history, but hopefully in a way that makes sense. I'm not saying it won't challenge, but hopefully in a way that makes sense. And in the second session, we're going to be looking at, okay, what does that really theologically look like in the Bible? What does it look like for the church? And where you might have practical questions, you can just ask them in the question and response time, and I'll try and answer them. What I won't be able to do, I'll tell you now, is I won't be able to say, oh, just down the road there, just at the end of Burnage Lane, there's a church that you can go in. It's a really great example. I won't be able to do that because the church has only just begun to grapple with the issue. And so churches are trying to work out, how do we really do this? It would be, I suppose, a bit like 50 years ago, if you had asked for evangelical charismatic churches, can I find one? In some places, they'll go, I've never heard of that kind of church. Whereas now, it would be a common thing. So just so you know, just want to temper your expectations here. So we're kind of talking about what's the issues in the first session, you know, really historically, why are we where we are? And then what's the potential solution when we go to scripture? Where does that take us? So that's kind of where we're going. And I mean, I don't know exactly everyone's obviously church background. So what will come out will be my church background in some of the way that I speak. Okay, when we think about things like affording your own home, getting married, you know, maybe getting into the job you really wanted or the university that you really wanted, having your first baby. I know we might not have all had babies, but you think about these moments, the excitement of getting something that you have deeply desired and worked for, you know, we would realize that if we got our first home and it was, as they call it, a fixer-upper, we would know that the hard work begins when you get the home. It may have been hard work to get the home, but the real hard work begins when you get the home. You don't get the home and walk in and go, oh my goodness, what happened to the walls? Yeah, if you know you're going into that kind of thing, or you don't get married and after the first week go, oh my goodness, what's going wrong here? You don't think like that. We recognize that the hard work begins when we get the thing that we have desired. Getting married was when the hard work began, not ended. Yeah, and if you've thought differently, I don't mean to kind of change that perspective, but it's true. Getting married is when it begins, because suddenly things about you are being exposed that you didn't know you had. It's not like when it ends. When I think about the church and I think about my own church experience and I think about the last 40 or 50 years of church, there was a moment, or 40, 50 years ago, where God put into the hearts of some people by his Holy Spirit a desire to see the church restored. Now, if you're younger than 40, you might have read about this, but you wouldn't necessarily have experienced it. But I remember experiencing it. And we had this experience, and it kind of happened in two ways. In the established church, and by that I mean like the Anglican Church or the Baptist Church, you had what they called renewal. But you also had this other thing called restoration, which was when new churches were birthed and new churches came out. I remember being in my church and in those early days, because I was raised in that kind of environment, where people would visit us from other churches because they wanted to see the moment when people spoke in tongues. Yeah, it was a kind of a thing. Yeah, I remember the first time I saw somebody in church dance. Yeah. And my brother and I, we just killed ourselves because this woman couldn't dance, but she was dancing in church. And we were like, when did that happen? When did that become a thing? Yeah. So I remember those things. I remember hearing and being in just observing the emergence of apostles and prophets and pastors and teachers and this new vitality to church life, small groups. Churches never used to have small groups. Charismatic worship, and I don't just mean lifting the hands, but worship where you'd sense the Holy Spirit was with you and among you and people were speaking and all these kinds of things. A new vigor for seeing and moving in signs and wonders, evangelism. I remember all these things, and some of you might remember. Worldwide mission emerged. I imagine some of the churches even birthed in places like Manchester came from people who had that kind of heart and desire. For me, two of the things that gripped me over the years that I suppose really got hold of me, one was a love for the local church. Yeah, when I gained understanding of God's bride and God's plan and God's purpose was through the church. And the second was an understanding of grace, that actually I was saved by grace. It wasn't by my performance. It wasn't by my efforts. And so the church has kind of been built through that kind of thing for the last 40 plus years. I would argue this. In many ways, we have seen the church restored. Churches have changed beyond all recognition. Churches that started in homes meet in warehouses. New churches are taking over buildings. The overspill of those days has touched churches right across the nation and beyond. So it's not just a UK thing, it's right across the nation. The restoration of the church, though, did not solve all the inherent problems that we had. It solved many, but it didn't solve all of them. A friend of mine who was raised in South Africa describes being in a church that experienced powerful restoration, baptism in the Holy Spirit, speaking in tongues, visions, healings, prophecies, and all those kinds of things, whilst at the same time living in and with the reality of segregated South Africa. It didn't change that. It didn't change the fact that in those churches, ethnic black and white people, because you wouldn't call them minorities because in South Africa black people are in the majority, they were not allowed to worship with white people. Yeah? So although I'm speaking in tongues and bringing prophecy and seeing healings, I'm still saying that certain people can't be with us. Yeah? I'm still thinking, no, we're better off than they are. And in fact, if they, when they did initially first join, begin to kind of break down segregation, it was, okay, you can join us, but you kind of need to just be there. Don't say anything. And yet these churches were restored. They were the restored church, if you will. It did not remove the dividing wall of hostility. And in fact, when those churches began to grow in their diversity, when that moment, because really it was a political moment that shifted South Africa and people were then free to join other churches. When that happened in that nation, many, many, many of the white people in those churches left when the churches became integrated. And Christians did that without a thought of conscience. There wasn't a sense of guilt in that. There was, oh, well, you know, if you're doing that thing, well, we're going to go and do this. Yeah? Partly because segregation was seen almost as a theological thing. Yeah? That was how we understood the church. In our own nation, we, the church, along with everyone else, were shocked when we heard about the death of George Floyd. Now we're probably a little bit tired of it, but we were shocked at the time when we heard about it. And what it did is it opened up countless stories and experiences that ethnic minority people were having in our nation, but also shock and horror in our churches. That brothers and sisters told of experiences in the church which you would have expected them to have outside of the church, that you didn't expect them to have in the church. The power of those stories were more compelling because some of those brothers and sisters, we might have known them for years. And we had no idea. We had no idea of the experiences that they were going through. We were completely unaware of the pain and that people might have been feeling. And yet, I would say again, the church, at a very fundamental level, has been restored. It is not perfect, but it has been restored. There is New Testament church life in churches that was not there 50 years ago. So what's happened? Is it just that people have got more used to issues than we realised? Maybe their understanding of grace hasn't sufficiently kind of allowed them to kind of accept the status quo? Are we simply being influenced by secular culture when we talk about these issues? Is it the case of when you saw this one on the list, you're thinking, well, you know, are we going a bit kind of woke here? What's going on? What's happening to the church? Is that how we're thinking about it? Because in secular culture, equality, fairness, and individuality really sit on the throne. They are the idols of our generation. But they're not the idols of the church, or they ought not to be. Or is there something more to it? I remember a couple of years ago, I can't remember when we did it, because you know when you have these memories, you kind of want to forget them. So we, our daughter lives in Blackpool, and we went up there to lay turf in her garden. Yeah, so it's not the kind of thing I want to do. I don't like that kind of thing. But we were laying turf in her garden, and I remember we got 2 tons of soil, and we had to dig it out. And we dug it out, and we put down some weed suppressant, and we put out the turf. And that took like all day, yeah? And so at the end of the day, I'm like, at least we've done it. And then my wife said to me at the end of the day, she said, I think we should have taken the weed suppressant up. I said, no, we don't need to do that. I said, it'll be fine. She was like, no. I've been looking, I think we need to take it up. And I was like, no, we don't need to take it up. And obviously, we don't need to take it up because I'm like, are you kidding me? We've just spent a whole day putting that stuff down and covering it with 2 tons of soil. And now you're wanting us to take... I was like, no, we don't need to take it up, my love. We don't need to. Yeah. And so we went to bed and I think I probably had a bit of a sleepless night because I knew I didn't want to take it up. But I also knew deep down in my heart, I think she's probably right. Yeah, deep down in my heart, I kind of knew she was right, but I did not want to face it. I thought we'd finish the job. Yeah, I didn't want to face it. So the next day, we get up and we have to take up this weed suppressant. And because I knew what my attitude was, I just worked hard at just being able to do it. Yeah, so we just did it. When you've had a job that you think you've completed, when you discover that you're not yet halfway through, that can be quite demoralizing, or it can be quite, what are you talking about? What I want to say about the church, I've said it a few times this morning, the church has been restored, but it has not been reconciled. It has not been reconciled. The church might have new church life and all of those things that I talked about it, but the inherent problems that are in the church are to do with relationships. It's to do with people. It's not to do with how we work. It's to do with who we are. If we have been through a period of the restoration of the church, we're needing to go through a period of the reconciliation of the church. Yeah? We need to become one. Not just like, oh, you know, theologically, of course we're one, Owen. Don't you know that? No, we need to become one. Why? So that the world will know. So there is something about reconciliation. I've got this quote from Dan B. Allender, this is what he writes. He's talking about Jim Collins, who wrote the book Good to Great. He says, in his book Good to Great, Jim Collins tells the story of meeting Jim Stockdale, one of his personal heroes, who had been the highest ranking officer in the infamous Hanoi Hilton, the North Vietnamese prisoner of war camp. When Collins asked Stockdale how he survived, Stockdale told him that he made it because of his faith, that his story would turn out well. Collins then asked what kind of people didn't survive. And the former prisoner of war quickly answered, the optimists didn't survive. The optimists thought that they would be released by a set date, such as Christmas. And when the date came and went, they lost their resolve to live. Collins writes, another long pause and more walking. Then he turned to me, the writer of the book, and said, this is a very important lesson. You must never confuse faith that you will prevail in the end, which you can never afford to lose, with the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be. To this day, I carry a mental image of Stockdale admonishing the optimists, we're not getting out by Christmas, deal with it. Some of us had thought, as I said, the restoration of the church was it. We've changed the expression of Christianity around the world, but it's almost like we've begun to discover there's a new room, there's a new way, there's a new unplowed field, a new space that we have not yet touched. The restoration of the church, I would argue, was only in half the job. The church was restored. The church has successfully been restored to the point where it can now be reconciled. But it also could be something else. But it can now be reconciled. The restoration of the church, the bringing in of New Testament values, is what we build reconciliation on. You can't reconcile the church if you do not understand the grace of God. Let me tell you that. You can't reconcile the church if you do not understand how the Holy Spirit works with people. You can't do it. But you can, when you know those things, you can do it. We're to move, though, it seems to me, from a period of restoration to a period of reconciliation. The need for grace is such an important example. But by that, I don't simply mean grace as in, this is something I've received from God. I have been accepted. Isn't it wonderful? God has saved me and he's drawn me into himself, and it's not to do with anything that I've done. That's a wonderful truth. Yeah? Which if you're a Christian, you need to know. But you know what? There's another part of that truth. You need to learn to extend that same grace to other people. Just as the Bible talks in Corinthians, doesn't it? It says, comfort those with the comfort you yourselves have received from God. Extend grace to those with the grace that you yourselves have received from God. Yeah? And what do I mean by grace at that point? Fundamental acceptance. Because that's what was extended to you. God accepted you before you ever did anything. Whilst we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Yeah? So God accepted you before you ever did anything. You need to learn to accept others in the same way. In the same way we receive forgiveness and we give forgiveness. Yeah? We receive comfort, we give comfort. We receive grace, we extend grace to other people. And if we're going to reconcile the church, that's a really important part of it. Reconciliation is about building relationships across the divides and across differences. It's not purely about, oh, you know, the world just has become more diverse. Do you know what I mean? People now live everywhere. And you know, Pauline and I, we travel to different parts of the country. And the truth is, our nation has become more diverse. You know, we would go to Plymouth. We went to Plymouth a couple of weeks ago. We were in Teesside not that long ago. Both of them are diverse. Yeah? Both of them, the churches are mixed up. Yeah? And so it's like, okay, God, you're sending people everywhere, but you're doing that for a purpose. That's not just a case of that's what happens with modern day migration. This is God's purpose to demonstrate that his church is an example to the world. In the days of us becoming more reconciled, we just need to think about what does it look like for us. So if you're one of the optimists in the room and you're thinking, but I thought the church was okay, I thought we'd done it, you may feel overwhelmed, discouraged, disillusioned. You may just feel defensive. No, I'm not going to accept that, Owen. I'm not going to. No. In your deep in your heart, you know, but actually you're like, no, I'm not going to do it. The pessimists among us might feel cynical, faithless, and even defensive. There will be, though, even in a room like this, people who sit in the middle. You're neither optimistic nor you're pessimistic. What drives you is faith in the sovereignty of God to fulfill his purpose. And whereas you don't know what that looks like, you trust that he does and that he's directing us. Many of us will deeply desire unity in the church. I remember years ago, we went through a phase where unity was a thing. We'd sing, "Bind Us Together, Lord." There'd be other songs we'd sing about unity. But in reality, we don't pursue unity that much these days. We do with people who are like in our little circle, but beyond that, we don't really pursue unity that much. I sometimes wonder whether that's because we've become disillusioned about how unobtainable unity really seems to be. The unity we see pursued doesn't seem real or authentic. So we may shy away from it and focus on other stuff. Yet the Bible points to unity as something important. Psalm 133 indicates that unity is something that God blesses. Ephesians 4 speaks of the gifts being given to the church. Why? To help attain unity of the faith. John 17 talks about unity, and we're just going to look at some of the words of Jesus. John 17 is where Jesus prays just before he is he's arrested, and then he's tried, and then he's crucified. There's a moment where he's in the garden and he prays, and we get the contents of his prayer, and it's an intimate prayer. It's a powerful prayer because these are the words of Jesus. These are the final words of Jesus. Or more or less, I mean, he says some words on the cross and that, but these are some of the final words of Jesus that we see. And this is what he says in John 17. I mean, first off, he prays for himself. Secondly, he prays for his disciples. And then the third thing he does is he prays for others who will believe because of their message. And we come into that category. So we are among those that Jesus is praying for when he's in the garden in John 17. I don't know whether he has you in mind or me in mind, but he's praying for people like us. And this is what he prays. He says, "My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one. Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. So Jesus prays for us. This isn't a prayer while he's in heaven. This is a prayer while he's on earth. Yeah, in heaven we know he intercedes for us, but here on earth he prays for us. And he prays that his prayer is not for them alone. It's not for the disciples alone. It wasn't just for those few. It was also for beyond that. It was a faith-filled prayer looking ahead. I pray for those who will believe in me through their message. Jesus always anticipated the gospel would expand and grow. Right from that moment, he's praying. He's only got a handful of disciples, but he's anticipating this is going to grow. And so he prays for that. He prays that they may be one. He could have prayed many things. He could have prayed that they might be bold. He could pray that they might love one. He could pray for many, many things. But what he prays is that they'll be one. That's the prayer of Jesus. Yeah, at the heart of the gospel is this prayer that they would be one. And in many ways, he uses the example of the Trinity, because he talks about, Father, I'm in you and you are in me. Yeah, there's this picture of the oneness, the togetherness of the Trinity, the Father, the Son and the Holy Spirit. And he's praying that that would be the same in the church, that that oneness that exists there would also exist here. Perfect submission in intimate relationship. I'm not sure oneness is what we would have prayed. I don't know that it's I would have prayed. If I were coming to the end of my days and I brought my daughters in to me, I don't know. Maybe I would now say, talk about oneness, but maybe I wouldn't do. What would I say? What would you say? So he prays that there'll be one. He then prays that they'll come to complete unity. In the Bible, one of the examples of unity we read about is in marriage. Marriage is an example of oneness. Marriage is also a picture of the gospel. Yeah, one flesh. They're people who are different, but they come together. It's not necessarily talking about unity of agreement or unity of personality, but of heart, of togetherness, of mutual submission one to another. In Ephesians 2, because it's more than about marriage, when it talks about the Jews and the Gentiles, it talks about the ending of hostility. It talks about that passage is about the separation of foreigners and aliens and being brought together. And how are they brought together? They're brought together by the blood. And what happens when they're brought together? They're reconciled to him. They're reconciled both to him. And what does he bring in that relationship? He brings, the Bible tells us, peace. And then at the end of that passage in Ephesians 2, it says, and this is the community, the household in which God dwells by his Spirit. So God dwelt among the people. You know, he tabernacled among the people in the Old Testament. He was represented in the tabernacle and in the ark, and it was the presence of God. But actually in the New Testament, it moves on from that. It's no longer the tabernacle, a physical thing. It's in the hearts of the people that he dwells. Yeah? God comes and he dwells among his people, and that dwelling is coming to a people who are one, because he is one. And then he says at the end of that passage, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The unity we see described in John 17 is in and of itself part of the mission of the church. If the church is united, people will be drawn to it. You don't need to run around and tell everyone about Jesus. Yeah? If the church is united, you would need to invite people in and they would say, something is different here. Yeah? Because you can run around and tell people about Jesus and bring them to your church. But if you bring them to your church and your church reflects the same issues that they have in the world, that isn't like, oh, it's great, the church really understands. That's not what that does. That doesn't take them to Jesus. Because Jesus does something different to that. The church cannot just be a reflection of the world. The church has to be look different to the world. Not because we need to try really hard to be different. No, we must try really. No, we're not trying hard to be different. Jesus is different. And so if we reflect Jesus, the church will look different. And people will be drawn to that because that's what it says. Then the world will know. It doesn't say then. I know there are other passages that talk about mission and we can talk about that. But here it's talking specifically the world will know that Jesus came from God because of the unity of the believers. And then it talks about the motive behind all of this. And Jesus prays, you loved them even as you loved me. God's motive behind our unity, both in him and with one another, is to show the world his love. So we see that the unity in the Bible describes, we see it in relationships, in marriage, we see it between communities, it ends hostility, it brings peace. The common denominator with all of this is Jesus. He brings the peace, he holds it together, he's the central focus of it. Unity without him is not the same. So you can be united in purpose and agreement and values and all of that. That's very different to being united in Jesus. Yeah. Unity with him glorifies and honors his name. So why, though, do we need to be reconciled? Remember, my premise is actually the church needs to be reconciled before it can actually be united. Because we've not kind of just been beamed down here yesterday or this morning. We didn't just arrive on earth. Yeah? There's a history. Yeah? There's a life that's been lived. If you've had a difficult relationship and then one day somebody appeals to you, you guys need to be united. It's not enough just to go, okay, let's just forget the past and let's just get on. Sometimes that's not enough. Yeah? Sometimes that's not enough. You need to do more than that if you're going to build something that is truly united. And so in our current context, as I say, I'm saying that this is a neglected theology. This is not a new theology. Why has it come to light? It's come to light partly because of what's happened in the last few years. Yeah, the murder of George Floyd brought some stuff out. Yeah, I mean, we might not like to talk about it, but it brought some stuff out. It really did. It exposed a number of things. Let me just go through a number of things it exposed. First of all, it exposed the experience of racism and unconscious bias that ethnic minorities, not just in society, but also in the church, receive. Yeah, it exposed that. Yeah, it made that known to us in a way that felt uncomfortable. Secondly, it exposed, my observation of it, our theology of race and reconciliation in the church was insufficiently robust to handle what happened. And therefore, all sorts of other things get coming in to the church. It was insufficiently robust. We couldn't handle it. And what that meant was, you know, strongly theologically wired, mature Christians, their response to what happened was no different to somebody who was thoughtful and empathetic but didn't know Jesus. Yeah? And when I saw that, that surprised me, I'll be honest. It surprised me that believers responded no different to unbelievers. Oh, of course it's wrong to be racist. Of course it is. We couldn't say much more, though. We couldn't say much more. So our theology, it also exposed the lack of deep relationships between people from different minority groups and different parts of the church, despite the fact that they might have been worshipping together for years. I did not know those experiences. I remember growing up in a church, which was predominantly white. I remember growing up in the church, and I remember going to church, and that was one world. I remember coming out and living in a different world. Yeah? I just remember those experiences, that they were different. So it exposed the lack of relationships. It exposed the lack of ethnic minority leaders in churches, particularly at senior levels. Whilst this has always been an issue, it became more pronounced at that moment. we suddenly saw it. So I don't know what happened in your church, but on Zoom and lots of churches, you had suddenly people from all sorts of places hosting meetings, doing stuff. That wasn't happening before. It also exposed the reality and the complexity of dealing with the pastoral fallout of decades of racism, feelings of superiority, battles of inferiority mindsets, the pressures that people sometimes feel to assimilate into church simply to fit in. What do I need to do to fit in here? What do I need to do so that people don't reject me here? So I think the George Floyd thing exposed that. But you didn't need to go back much further to see other issues that it was dealing with. The issues were even deeper than that. That simply got exposed in that moment. But we go back decades in our own nation, and you have the Windrush generation, and you might have heard that term or not heard that term, but it really refers to people who came over to this country from the Caribbean in the 50s and the 60s. So my parents, yeah, they came over at that time, and when they got here, maybe they didn't receive the best welcome and all of those kinds of things. It also would talk about civil rights movement in the US. It would talk about apartheid in South Africa. That suddenly, we don't need to go back very far to see major injustices against people. But even before that, we see strongholds of ways of thinking that have shaped our world for years. It's my growing conviction, and this is just a personal one, it's not necessarily what everyone thinks, that the world we live in, one of our deepest worldviews is a racialized one. I do see the world by race. It will make a difference to me if 15 people from one race walked into the room and 15 people from another race walked into the same room. We would have a response to that. Obviously, some things have changed. And this is our biggest battle, because legislation has made things different. 200 years ago, if we lived 200 years ago, the chances are, my family from Jamaica, I would be growing up as a slave on a plantation in Jamaica. The thought 200 years ago that I might be standing in front of a group of people in Manchester talking to them would be an unthinkable thought. We wouldn't have even considered it. I wouldn't have even considered it. You might have had the odd person who was like really progressive, but most people, it wouldn't have even been a thought in their heads that that was a possibility. That would be like saying, oh, one day people are going to marry elephants. And we're like, oh, wow. And in AI, maybe they will. So some things have changed. Legislation has changed. But this is what Dr. Martin Luther King said about legislation, because there are limits to the changes that legislation can bring. He says this: well, it may be true that morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. It may be true that the law cannot change the heart, but it can restrain the heartless. It may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can restrain him from lynching me. And I think that is pretty important also. And so, while the law may not change the hearts of men, it does change the habits of men if it is vigorously enforced. And through changes in habits, pretty soon attitudinal changes will take place, and even the heart may be changed in the process. Obviously, I love Dr. Martin Luther King, huge respect, but I don't believe that last bit. I don't believe if you change habits, you will eventually change hearts. I don't think they're connected. Because God changes hearts. Yeah, habits can change. But God changes hearts. If changing the law was the answer, I do not believe racism would be an issue today. But it is. It is an issue. It remains an issue. People still experience it. And again, not to load it on you, but going back even a bit further, I visited Lambeth Palace, which is the headquarters of the Anglican Church, the Church of England. He's the Archbishop of Canterbury, but his headquarters is in London. I could got confused there. But Lambeth Palace is where he lives, which is on the bank of the Thames. I visited the library there, where they had decided to do a small exhibition on the Church of England's involvement in slavery. Yeah, just a couple of years ago, I visited this library. And there was the usual stories of all the abolitionists. We know them, William Wilberforce and Hannah More and other people who really worked on behalf of, you know, wanting to kind of change the law and to bring about the changes of the law. But also they brought our attention to other things. And one of them was this, the story of Morgan Godwin, 1685. He was an Anglican minister, 1685. Just remember that. So that's what, 300 plus years ago, nearly 350 years ago. He preached a sermon at Westminster Abbey to King James II. He called it Trade Before Religion, and he said these words: "We have exceeded the worst infidels by our first enslaving and then murdering, which is murdering, of men's souls. For how can it be endured that a nation once so famous for zeal and piety should prostrate herself to that vile, idle mammon and worship trade?" In other words, what he's saying is, I can't believe that we have engaged in the slave trade for the sake of money. Can't believe we've done that. Morgan Godwin disappeared in 1685. His voice was silenced. No one ever responded. Obviously, nearly over 300 years later, his voice is beginning to speak. And one of the things it's telling us, though there was a culture of the day that said slavery was an economic kind of viability and all of those things, there were people, believers, who said, no, that's just wrong. That is just wrong. So although people were products of their culture, when you have been changed by God, you're no longer products of the culture. Yeah? And you can see, no, that's just wrong. Yeah, I don't care what we gain from it. It's wrong. And there are some things that we know to be true. Second, there was a letter from a slave to a bishop, 1723. So what is that? That's like 300 years ago to last year. It was an anonymous petition addressed to the Lord Archbishop of London in August 1723. It was a letter from an enslaved person asking for the freedom of mixed race persons and an appeal for a Christian education. The writer claims that he's owned by his own brother. Whether this was a biological brother or not, it's not clear. What is clear is that he recognizes slavery was wrong. He never receives a reply. Yeah, so people saw it. That was a slave who saw it. This is wrong. This is not right. And then in 1807, I don't know whether you're aware of what happened in 1807. In 1807, was when the slave trade was abolished in the UK. So the British Empire abolished the slave trade in 1807. It doesn't abolish slavery until 1833. So there are 26 years where you own slaves, but you can't trade in them. And actually, from the moment it abolished slave trade, it was trying to force everyone else to do the same. But actually, you know, in the US, the slave trade's not abolished till the 1860s. In places like Brazil, it's not abolished till the 1890s, but in the UK, British Empire, it was abolished in 1807. One of the things that came out in 1807, though, was the Holy Bible for the Use of Negro Slaves, which was published in London in 1807, the year of the abolition of the slave trade. Only three copies are known to exist, and one of them was at this exhibition that I was, and then I went to buy it online. It was this massive book. So it's not easily transportable. It was published on behalf of the Society for the Conversion of Negro Slaves, which in some ways was a positive group. Yeah, they were on the side of the abolitionists. They published the Slave Bible under the direction of the Bishop of London, Belby Porteous, part of the abolition movement. Just listen to this. The Slave Bible excludes 90% of the Old Testament and 50% of the New Testament. The text skips from Genesis 45 to Exodus 19. So it skips the whole of the Exodus. Yeah, the slaves coming out of Egypt. It skips all of that. It misses much of that story. The following books are completely absent from the Slave Bible: Leviticus, Numbers, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 2 Samuel, 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Psalms, Song of Solomon, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. From the New Testament, these ones are completely absent. Mark, Colossians, Philemon, 2 Peter, 2 John, Jude, Revelation. There are only four books that appear in full: Matthew, Luke, Acts, and 1 Peter. And then there are aspects of John, Romans, and Ephesians. When I think about what I get from the Bible, the idea that someone completely redacted it, really for the purpose of controlling the slaves. So yes, we want you to have faith, but we kind of don't want you to have freedom. And these were on the side of, these were for it. They were for abolition. These weren't negative people, these were positive people. So when we think about all of that, we realize, just three quick observations before we can go and have conversations. First of all, that there is a troubled history around this stuff. Yeah, in our nation, there's a troubled history. It's a troubled and conflicting history where we kind of seem to take both sides at the same time, but maybe elevate one over the other. Slavery wasn't abolished until 1833, but the main delay for that was two activities. It was obviously the trade around stuff and ownership, and the argument really over compensation for slave owners. That was the main issue. I don't want to overly focus on that, but just so we know where the tide was. Secondly, I think there's the observation I would make, there's a blindness around race. The stronghold, in my view, of a racialized world we live in is so deep and entrenched that we are blind to it. And we normalize its effects and impact on people. And we don't even realize it. We don't realize that simply the color of your skin means that your experiences in this world are different. It's hard to even begin to contemplate that. Though, believe you me, it's true. It's true. We accept, albeit with some discomfort, some of us accept the reality of racial supremacy. You know, I've not talked about eugenics, but that would be another kind of conversation where we, the church, among others, decided that there was one race that was more superior, more closer to God than other races. We decided that. That was decided. It wasn't like there in the Bible. We placed it in the scripture. Flawed and misguided. And although that particular theology isn't held as a theology, the residue of those thoughts and feelings remain in our world today. Partly because we've never really dealt with it. The reason these issues come up today is not because minority groups are just, you know, defensive and moody and they just need to sort themselves out. It's because we've not resolved them. We have not reconciled these things. So we have this unresolved history. On the 22nd of June, I was at an event in London. It was the 75th anniversary of the Empire Windrush, which is the boat that kind of marks the coming of the Windrush generation to the UK. And we've obviously seen massive levels of integration and legislation that have changed to protect the rights of minority groups. But we've also seen the emergence of other things, where people were being sent home, having told you don't need to obtain a passport. Then when you didn't have a passport years later, they're being sent back to these places. It's an unresolved history. And for me, the church must kind of heed the warning. We can't be mistaken or fooled into thinking that simply the passage of time and legislative changes and levels of integration are signs of true reconciliation. You know that to be true. If you'd been in a very difficult relationship and it all broke down and you were still in the same church and you just didn't talk to one another, the fact that you're still in the same church and years later doesn't mean it's been resolved. You know that. That's life. That's, relationships don't work like that. I don't bash you up, walk away, and then 10 years later go, hey, are we all okay? It doesn't work like that. Sometimes we need to reconcile. And reconcile doesn't mean we all become best friends again, but it does mean we put right what's wrong. We sort it. Story of Jacob and Esau is a good example of that. So the question for us is, how are we doing? How are we doing? Churches in Manchester, how are we doing on this issue? Okay, we're going to pause there. Tom. Does anyone have a question? No, I'm really happy not to have questions. Okay, there's a question over here.
Hi. I'd just like to have your perspective on whether you feel that God is moving in a powerful and growing way in this matter, and that this reconciliation is starting to gather momentum, that God is moving, and you can see his fingerprints across Britain and the world. It's something that you believe is starting to happen. I just wanted to get your perspective on that.
Good question. And the short answer is yes, I do. I haven't always thought that, but I do think that now. I think that partly comes to me, partly because even, and I don't mean to just keep going on it, but the way the George Floyd thing happened, it happened at a time when the world was quiet. We were literally just coming out of COVID. It wasn't like we were all at work and we hadn't heard it. We saw it. And so I think for me, God's trying to, and God's not trying to get the attention of the world, he's trying to get the attention of the church. So that would be my thing. So my response to George Floyd was not, oh my goodness, what does the world need to do? My response to George Floyd was, oh my goodness, what does the church need to do? Because if we change the church, we change the world. And so there was that for me. Secondly, the other thing that lent me that way was the fact that so many churches have diversity in them all over the so it became a thing everywhere, and I think that has shown itself to me, because literally in the last 3 years I've been to all corners of this country talking about this in local churches. And probably the third thing is, I just think, oh, this is an unresolved issue. It's unresolved. And I was surprised at the way the church responded to it, in terms of it didn't have its theological response. It wasn't particularly strong. It wasn't particularly deep. In fact, a lot of it was silence. We didn't say anything because we didn't know what to say. And I'm like, we don't respond like that to marriage. We don't respond like that to other things, but we did respond like that to this. And then probably my own, you know, and you'll see in the next session, just my own journey in the scriptures has led me to go, oh, this is in there. This is there. And I think it's interesting that it's race reconciliation that God has brought to the fore, not just race. So it's not, this is not just about the theology of race. And then I was invited to a keynote speech done by the Archbishop of Canterbury, I don't know, it was 18 months ago. And he had made reconciliation one of his personal goals as the Archbishop. So I'm like, oh, okay, you're seeing something that, okay, not everyone's talking about it, but you're seeing something. And it's quite academic. He's written a book about it called The Power of Reconciliation. But he's seen something that says this has become a thing. And so, yeah. So I think God is at work, and everything I've done in the last 3 or 4 years probably convinces me of that more.
I'm going to jump in and just ask a follow-up. So you mentioned about the response of the church to George Floyd, and
the response not being as you would have hoped. Could you outline what a more appropriate, better response from the church might have looked like?
I can try. One of the reasons I think the church responded in the way it did was because it simply exposed that that was an issue in the church. So it wasn't that, had the church done this and that, it would have been better. The church literally didn't know what to do because it didn't know what to do. And so for me, the better response would have been around not silence, maybe going, "Oh, I didn't know this. I am really sorry to hear this. I don't know what we need to do here, but you just need to know that." Because some people said that, but loads of people said nothing. Yeah, and I sit in a world where I connect to dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of pastors all across the country. Most leaders said nothing. A lot of movements said nothing. So I think that kind of initial response. I think also when hearing the stories, because obviously people did do that for a while, they listened to the stories and all of that. For me, that wasn't enough just to listen to the stories. I personally think the diversity in your church, God has sent that to shape your church in some way, and it should influence how you do church, because there will be people in your church who have faith in certain things that you don't have, but you need. And so I think even that. But I also just think it's been a journey for the church, and that the level of relationship required to really build diversely is a bigger thing than people think. Fewer people maybe asked for help than I imagined. Yeah, just fewer. So yeah.
Hi. To continue the question, how do you think we should use that diversity within the church to better the wider community? How do we, like, sort of capitalize on that to better our churches and better the connections between churches?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think first off, we probably need to kind of broaden a little our understanding of the church as family, because the breadth that God has given to you is part of the family of God. So it's not purely there to be used, it's part of the family. And how do I ensure that the family feel welcome and can play their part in the community? What can I learn from people who come in? So I think there is that. And I think that takes relationship. And you'll see in the next session that would be a big thing for me. How do you build relationships with people who are different to you, like real relationships? Because what I've realised is we do build levels of relationship with people who are different to us, but maybe we build them because, you know, we can use them hosting and doing this and doing that in the church, and we're not really building relationships. And I say that because some of the feedback I've had in different parts of the country from minorities who are in churches, one of the reasons they have been hesitant to step in is because they don't feel they're really known. And what they mean by that is, if I'm having a bad day, they won't know that because they don't know me well enough. So then I might feel exposed if I kind of step into leadership and I'm doing whatever it is they're wanting me to do. They don't really know me. And then another person made a comment about, we haven't yet learned how to love each other well. And so I think that focusing on those things, on a really practical level, I know churches that run things like language schools. Yeah, I think that's a brilliant thing because you can help people, but actually helping people to speak English when they live in England helps them. Yeah, it just helps them. And so I think doing things like that can really help. And you don't, you know, forget the New Testament. Go to Exodus where the Bible says, don't oppress the foreigner and the alien. You know, and in fact, God says in Deuteronomy, I think it is, I love the foreigner among you, giving him food and clothing. Yeah, there's a way that God thinks about people who come to you that we sometimes don't, that we sometimes forget. And the Exodus, when they come out, there are foreigners and aliens among them. And God makes allowance for that. And so how much more should we not make allowance for that in the church? So those are some of my thoughts.
So it was more just kind of like the conversations the group we actually had. And it was more that I sort of picked out as a subtext about communities. So if you look at like the sort of first century church for the first few centuries, they had a shared experience. So they lived as a community, as one, and had probably that shared experience of persecution. Now, today, we don't. We kind of like live in the world, and probably like on a Sunday, we're a community. So there's kind of that disparity between the two. Do you feel that kind of moving more to reconciliation is a better understanding and empathy between us if we go back to being more of a community as opposed to just working or living within an institution?
Yeah, so I've reflected on that kind of question a lot. Where I go to on that, and this is what I see in the scripture, and you know, is the thing that draws us together, the thing that makes us community, is what Jesus has done. It's not shared experiences, it's not commonalities, it's not, oh, we both support Man City or we support West Ham. It's not that. Those things are there, you know, and I'm not saying that they're bad, but the thing that draws you together with other believers is Jesus. And actually, he has to be the center, because that passage in Ephesians 2 talks about he reconciled them both together. Yeah? So Jesus does something that draws people. So everything you do as a church needs to have that unique aspect to it. It's not so much celebrating our differences. Look, there were 20 people from 20 nations here, or 30 nations. Great, fine. What really matters is that Jesus brought us together, and isn't that amazing that he did that? And so I think the focus has to be that. There are things you can then do that help that. What focuses? Well, we all pray to Jesus. We all worship Jesus. We all read the Bible about Jesus. We fellowship around Jesus. So those things become really important to the church, not simply the things that you might do locally that are kind of, oh yeah, you know, people here, they like to play five-a-side football. Yeah, fine. But that has to be secondary to what really brings you in the same room as these people is Jesus. It's not those things. So that would be my kind of understanding or my conviction around that.
Do you think the church has, or should, or can repent? Can forgiveness, is forgiveness an element of this reconciliation?
So repentance, forgiveness, for sure it is. What I won't do is say it needs to look like this or it needs to look like that. Yeah. Actually, so one of the learnings that I have made personally is the journey of reconciliation, the journey towards reconciliation. And I read this wonderful book called The Journey Towards Reconciliation, and by a guy called John Paul Lederach. And he had one chapter, which I've then taken and expanded, about the story of Jacob and Esau. And he talks about the journey of reconciliation in relation to that story. So this idea that we know the story of Jacob and Esau. Jacob comes face to face with some stuff. You know, he wrongs his brother. He does. And he then has to go on a journey of coming face to face with himself, face to face with God. Ultimately, he comes face to face with his brother, where they are reconciled, but they're not reunited. It's not like everything's the same as it was before. They go their separate ways, but they are reconciled. There are two aspects to that that I found important. One was, it was God who sent him back to reconcile. Yeah, it wasn't his choice. God said, I want you to go back, I'll be with you. Yeah, and when Jacob went back, he knew that in order for him to inherit all the promises that God had, he had to reconcile with his brother. He wasn't going to inherit without. Yeah, all the land that God had promised him. And then sometimes, you know, and then the other, I suppose, learning I had was, we can sometimes think, well, you know, in that story, am I Jacob or am I Esau? What am I? Well, I think if you're part of the people of God, you're Jacob. Jacob was the son of the promise. Jacob was the one who had to sort it. Yeah, and you find that when he comes to Esau, Esau's like, well, hey, I'm fine. Yeah, Jacob's not fine. Jacob is having to grapple with what's happened in the past, what's happened to him, all the things that God has done to him. He's been changed by the journey of reconciliation that finally amounts to him meeting with his brother. But it's the whole journey that changes him. He walks with a limp. He's now called Israel. All of these things happen in that journey towards coming to Esau. What I learned from it is when I, just even on a practical level in my own life, when I have disputes and difficulties and disagreements with people, sometimes what I do is I deliberately, you know, and I'm a pastor, so this happens, doesn't it? So I've got to arrange a meeting, I've got to see someone. And I remember there was one person, this kind of summarizes it for me. There was one person who said, I really want the honest conversation. I said, okay, let's have the honest conversation. We set a date, and between the moment we had that conversation and the time we met, God works in me. So it's not the honest conversation, Owen, you need to show grace. You need to show grace. And so I finally go into the meeting in a very, very different place. I'm not here to point out fault. I'm not here to whatever. And so I have found that journey of reconciliation is becoming more and more my experience. And so I think we all probably need to go on journeys of reconciliation and putting things right. Yeah? That one of the sad realities of churches is sometimes we plant churches because we don't know how to reconcile. So two leaders, they break up and they go off to plant, and you act like, isn't it great what God's doing? But they're going off to plant because they've not been able to reconcile things here. Yeah. And I'm like, well, what does that mean then? You're going and planting a church that doesn't know how to reconcile. Yeah. So I think it's a journey that we're on around reconciliation. And I don't particularly go into what does that mean? Does that mean recompense? Does that mean restitution? Does that mean I don't know the answer to those things. What I do know is if I want to follow God and inherit all that he has for me, there are moments where I need to put things right.
Well, hopefully you enjoyed this teaching and found it really beneficial. If you'd like to know more about the Manchester School of Theology, or there's any way we can serve you, please do check out our website. It's www.schooloftheology.co.uk. And we'll be back soon with more theology content hitting your podcast feed.